Yagyan Yalgi Nakchang Saham Padma Kesa Dong Bohula Yatsan Choyki Nodrupne Padma Yunge She Sutrak Kodo Kandro Mang Poko Kaiki Gesu Daktra Hupki Chingi Lapjia Sheksu Sohong Guru Padma Siddhi Hong. Or in English. To the northwest in the land of Ugyan, in the calyx of a lotus flower, O wanderers, the highest city has been attained by Padmasambhava thus famed. O you who are surrounded by an entourage of darkness, following your example will I work. You must come here and give me your blessing, Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. So, what I'm going to do is just briefly evoke Padmasambhava as a figure, then talk a little bit about the story of this particular, we'll tell you the story of where this prayer came from, then kind of give you a bit of analysis of the significance of the individual lines and finish with some reflections on how this might be relevant to us. So yeah, so just to give the very briefest sketch of Padmasambhava as a figure. So he's a historical mythical figure. So somebody took Buddhism to Tibet, and that is a historical fact. And lots of people say it was a man called Padmasambhava. So there must have been somebody who did that. That happened in the 8th century of the Common Era. But the story, the legend of Padmasambhava expands much more broadly, much more widely than that. So in his most extensive record of his life, called The Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, the character, the figure of Padmasambhava expands to become synonymous with growth. So he's seen as the force that brings about human growth in life. The Tibetans think of him as the second Buddha, and like in this particular account, it's almost like he's bigger than the Buddha. The Buddha is just one expression, one living forth of this energy, the capacity for human unfoldment, the capacity for human freedom. And subsequent to his historical emergence in the 8th century, bringing Buddhism to Tibet, then throughout the coming hundreds and hundreds of years, he re-emerges in people's minds. So you've got this, what's called the Terton tradition, where, as tradition would have it, his key disciples in that era of Tibetan history, he kind of planted mind treasures within them. He planted mysteries that they would uncover in the years and centuries to come. And that represents a renewing force within Tibetan Buddhism, which keeps on re-expressing the core values of Buddhism again and again and again. Right up until the modern era, there's 19th century Tertons, treasure finders, probably those in the 20th century as well. So really what we have here is a tremendous force, a tremendous energy. As I say, located particularly in this crucial period of bringing Buddhism to Tibet, but actually expanding much more broadly than that prior to that point in history and subsequent to that point. So the figure of Padmasambhava, he's particularly, as I said briefly this morning, he's particularly associated with this transformative impulse for what brings about change. And often that can be presented as a like a force, you know, like addressing the stuck, the blocked, the unintegrated, the messy, the complex. In his history, he's very much seen, well, his, the reason he was required to bring Buddhism to Tibet, because Buddhism was a messy, complicated, unintegrated, demonic country, and it required, like, nice head Buddhism wasn't enough. They had head Buddhism, they needed gut Buddhism, they needed heart Buddhism, and that's what Padmasambhava brought. But it is really important for, to remember, to understand that his sole motivation is love. So you can't, sometimes you see it more clearly, you know, these images of Padmasambhava, he's got kind of skulls, he's got this slightly fierce face, or this fierce face, which sometimes people can have a very strong reaction to. I suppose for me, I find it interesting when I look at the figure of Padmasambhava, I don't see the skulls. They just don't register for me, because what I see is love. What I see is love. So it's important, obviously the skulls are there, but it's important to remember that's where he's coming from. That's what's motivating him. So I said that was going to be a brief introduction. So that's, for those of you who aren't familiar with Padmasambhava as a figure, hopefully that gives you at least enough of a tiny sense before we embark on this particular theme of today. So the story. Everybody likes stories, don't they? So this is a... this is more mythical than historical, shall we say. So one point in Buddhist history, we're not quite sure when, it might be before the official life of Padmasambhava, it might be afterwards, probably it's before actually, so Bodh Gaya, the heart of Buddhism, the soul of Buddhism, the place where the Buddha gained awakening. And there's a problem in Bodh Gaya. So the Buddhists are there, and they're good Buddhists, and they're wise, and they're kind, but they're head Buddhists, to use that slightly unfortunate terminology. And they've got a problem, because at that time in Indian society, there's a rule that people weren't into football matches. They didn't have football teams, and they didn't have kind of football cups, but they did have kind of religious debates, kind of. It's like, if you imagine, it's like Bake Off or something like that, or some kind of, like, it's a showdown. So the heterodox, the non-Buddhist teachers, were coming to Bodh Gaya, and there was going to be a showdown. And the way the showdown worked is that both sides would kind of, their best girl would step forward, and they would present their understanding of the truth, their understanding of the teachings. And what's significant about this is the side which won, the side which presented their understanding of the teachings, or understanding of the truth most coherently, everybody else had to convert to their side. So do you see what I mean? It's a bit like Conkers, you know. So you're playing Conkers, and when you beat the other side, you take all of the points of their conquer. Anybody remember that? Yeah, there you go. It's a bit like Conkers. So the heterodox, the non-Buddhist teachers are coming to Bodh Gaya. And normally that would be fine. This has happened many times before, and the Buddhists are all good. They've got their clear, coherent understanding of conditionality, their clear presentation of karma. They've got it down. But this time there's a problem, because these guys do black magic. So they don't just... their ideas are reasonable, their ideas are good, but the key problem is that they've got Jedi mind tricks, and when they're talking, the other guys are making the Buddhist guy, lose his words and get all confused with their mind powers. And they're really good at this, and the Buddhists are like, we're doomed. We can't, you know, what can we do? We can't counteract this. We don't have the mind powers. We don't have the magic tricks. We can't fight this. So this is a really big deal. So Buddhism, the heart, you know, Bodh Gaya, the heart of the Buddhist tradition, is going to be lost to Buddhism. This is a problem. They're worried, they're concerned, they've got something invested. So it's the night before, and or maybe it's the night before, and they all go to sleep, and they all have the same dream. So that's significant, isn't it? Dreams moving into the realm of the unconscious. So in this dream, Darkani, one of these, often they're red, these wisdom, female wisdom figures which live in the sky. Darkani can be translated as skywalker or sky maiden. So this red sky maiden comes to all of them in their dreams. Her name is Ziwa Shok, supreme peace. And she says, "You will not be able to defeat the heretics if you do not invite here my elder brother, Dorje Trotsren Sal. He lives in the dark cemetery. If you do not do this, the Dharma will be destroyed." So Trotsren Sal is one of many names of Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava, because he appears in different places and in different contexts and does different things, he's got all of these different names. So this name means something like the Vajra skull garland of power. Rah. So they've had this dream and they've been told they need to invite Padmasambhava, but they've got two problems. One is he lives in a cemetery which is dangerous and hard to get to, and two, it's happening tomorrow and that's far away. So in their dream they say to this Darkani figure, they say, "It's far away, we can't get there, it's dangerous, what can we do?" And she says, "On the rooftop of your monastery, set up a great fire and burn lots of incense and chant this 7-line prayer and my brother will hear you and my brother will come." So they all wake up and they're all like, you know, I don't know if you've ever had a strong dream, a dream which you wake up from and it's resonating, it affects you, you can feel its power. So I've certainly had dreams like that. I've had dreams when I've woken up from them and I've known that I have to do something which I do not want to do, which will be difficult and will be hard. But I know that I have to do it. Yeah. I've had dreams which I've woken from and it's been the single most scary experience of my life, the most liberating, the most open experience of my life, but also the single most scary experience of my life, which happened in a dream because it was a invitation to openness which my psyche was fearful of. So it was a powerful dream. It felt powerful, and then they started talking to their friends and they realized they'd all had the same dream, at which point it becomes very, very powerful. And they say, "Okay, well, we've got to do this then." So they go to the top of their monastery, they build like a fire, they burn all this incense, and they chant many, many times the 7-line prayer, for one which I just recited for you, the one we were chanting many times this morning. And Padmasambhava comes. He appears in the sky, he descends. He's a lots of association with magic, and he's a magical figure, so he appears from the sky and he descends. And he says, "What's your problem?" And they say, "We need you to defend Bodh Gaya, to protect it, to save it from the heretics, whoever the heretics are." And he says, "Okay, let's go." So they go and do the debate, and he presents the Dharma in a way, well, he just presents the Dharma, which is that beautiful combination of real clarity, but also real depth, real lived, where he really brings head and heart together. They're not separate. He's not talking in abstract ideas or ideas which he's outside of his experience. He's fully living it and he's making it really, really accessible. And it's good. And you can see the heretics going, "Oh, that's true. That's how life works, isn't it?" But then the lead heretic starts doing his mind powers. And Padmasambhava doesn't miss a beat. Because what is the metaphor for mind powers? I suppose what it's pointing to, you could say, is a disconnect in our experience. So it's a good idea, but it's not a lived experience. So and the heretic is kind of exacerbating that difference or kind of making it more obvious. But Padmasambhava doesn't have that problem. He's totally integrated this. So he is one with the teaching. There is no disconnect. There is no separation between wisdom and experience. So he just dissipates the heretic's magical attacks. So he wins the debate. everybody, all of the heretics join the side for Dhamma, and everyone's happy, and they all rejoice. Hooray! And he said to them, if you ever need my help, chant this seven-line prayer. That's why, that's the story. And in the life of Padmasambhava, this kind of seven-line prayer emerges again and again, particularly in the minds of these Tertrons, these people who kind of spontaneously, well, Dharma teachings emerge from their unconscious. Dharma teachings emerge on the basis of need. So it comes up again and again, many, many different teaching cycles. It emerges. So in the Nyingma tradition, the kind of the oldest school of Buddhism, it's a really kind of central thing, and they do it all the time. So that's the story. So what does it mean? So that's an interesting question, isn't it, when you're in the realm of myth and imagination. But we can say something about what it means. We can say something about what it means. So there's these different, in a way, there's these different movements, there's different moods as we go through the literal meaning of it. So it starts off, when I sang it earlier, I used slightly different words in English because that's the translation I know, but I'm going to use Sangharakshita's one now. So to the northwest of the land of Ergyen. So in a way, it starts off in the physical, in the real, in the experiential. Ergyen is a country which they sort of got a sense of where it was. So it's a place. So in a place, in time and space. So we've got groundedness. Then we have on the calyx of a lotus flower. So those of you who aren't familiar with the life story of Padmasambhava, he's renowned, he's famous for not having been born, not taking literal birth. So he's, the mythology, the story goes that in this vast lake, this huge red lotus emerged. And out of this red lotus, like a red lotus, I don't know, like half the size of this room or a quarter of the size of this room. And in that red lotus, there was an eight-year-old spontaneously born boy child. Instantly, oh, so pure, wise from the start. So this, in the calyx of a lotus flower, this is what's being evoked for Padmasambhava literally means lotus born. So his birth, his mysterious, magical, mythical birth from a lotus. Oh, wondrous, the highest siddhi has been attained. So the highest siddhis are their attainments, their accomplishments of wisdom, of compassion. So the highest siddhi, of course, is awakening. So what's being evoked here is that Padmasambhava is awakened. He is a Buddha. He's called the second Buddha. So we start off with the physical, the real, a time, a place, and then we emerge, then we enter into the mythic, the archetypal. So then we have, thus Padmasambhava declares. So this is, in a way, an interesting point. There's Buddhism again and again, what you see is these kind of resonances for core truths, because again and again, we'll come back to this. The message of the Dharma is, although it uses the language of myth, of imagination, it always comes back to experience. So thus Padmasambhava declares. So he knows that he is awakened. And this, of course, has a strong parallel with the incident in the Buddha's life when we're at the point of awakening, he's challenged by Mara. Mara says, who do you think you are to be awakened? Many of you remember that story. This last challenge the Buddha faced. And the Buddha touches the earth. He calls upon confidence. He calls upon the groundedness and the knowledge of his own experience, and he touches the earth. Which, of course, has got really important parallels for us in our own lives in terms of, well, confidence, trust, faith. And Padmasambhava is doing the same thing here. He declares he knows. It's not arrogant, it's not conceited, it's experienced. O thou who art encircled with an entourage of darkness. So here, what's being evoked is this image of, people often describe Padmasambhava as a one-man sangha. So they use that, there are lots of different You could give a whole, spend a whole talk evoking what that phrase means, but just to try and say something about it. So Padmasambhava is a one-man sangha. Really what is being evoked here is, the Dharma is an alive force, as a moving, as a breathing, as an experienced thing. So, the Dharkanis, these wisdom spirits, they live in the sky, they're alive, they're moving, they're free-flowing, their energy is activated and liberated. And Padmasambhava is encircled by these. You could say he's encircled by them, but also he's one with them. The separation between him and them is not very strong, it's not very distinct. He's integrated. And because he's integrated, he's got all of the energies of his being at his service. Following thy example will I work. So again, we come back to this. Well, in a way, this key resonance with Buddhism again and again. Following your example will I work. So we've just heard that Padmasambhava is a mythically born being who arrived, entered into the world as an eight-year-old, fully formed human being who was already enlightened, who's totally integrated all of the messy, complex parts of his being. They're all in play, and they're all actually on board with the Dharma. And now we're saying we're going to do the same thing too. That's quite a thing to say, isn't it? That's quite a thing to live up to. It's like, following your example, will I work? It's like, well, can we really do that? We can't. Obviously, that's not literally possible. We cannot be spontaneously born from a lotus as awakened eight-year-old children because we have already been born. That is not an option. So what does it mean to say this? Following thy example, will I work? Well, it's a really... I think it's got two components to it, both of which are really important. One of them is, again, this the emphasis on the possibility of growth and aspiration. So Buddhism isn't saying Padmasambhava is a kind of like an enlightened god which you must follow. It's saying even though he's profoundly and unimaginably free and liberated, that's still a point on a continuum, on a journey, which we're all on. So it's not this... rather than binary opposites, humans, God, it's a continuum from unawakened to awakened. And wherever we are on that spectrum, we can always unfold, we can always expand. And that's even when the example is as profound as Padmasambhava, who is, the Buddhist tradition would say he was more awakened than the Buddha, if that were possible, because he was born that way. We can aspire. So this core message of Buddhism, we can aspire, we can grow, there is no limit. Wherever you are, the next step is the most important step. And of course, we've got this evocation of, well, the importance of altruism. Padmasambhava is decisively following the Bodhisattva path. He's not trying to get awakening for his own sake because he's already got it. His sole purpose in life is to help support other beings to liberate their energies, to find freedom. And we can be on that journey too. Obviously, it's more complicated for us because we are not liberated ourselves, but nonetheless, we can be on that journey too. Remember that. Thou must come here to give me thy blessing. So in a way, this is... From the Tibetan tradition, they would see this as being the most important line. This is the crucial point of the prayer. This is the prayer when you're saying, well, we're asking for help, we're asking for support, we're calling upon wisdom energies to help us unlock our own energies. It's a request. So of course this is, it's interesting, isn't it? Because probably for most of us, the idea of literally calling upon a literally existing mythical figure is probably, that's the point when that directly starts activating this is religion and it's weird and I'm really not sure if I believe in that and I do not know what you mean when you say that. So just to acknowledge that very straightforwardly, like what does it mean? what does it actually mean to say, to kind of say, Padmasambhava, come here and bless me? What are we actually doing when we're saying that? In some ways, this is the mystery of prayer, and I'm not going to give you a neat, tidy answer, because I don't think there is a neat and tidy answer. It's something to reflect upon. You could see that as a cop-out on my part, which it probably is, at least partially, let's be honest. I don't know, I'm okay with that. But to give you a few thoughts on that theme. So this is Buddhism straying into Buddhism kind of, Buddhism talks a language of self-power and other power. And most of us, our initial encounters with Buddhism are very, very strongly located in the language of self-power. I can change. I can stop doing this and I can start doing that. I can work on my mind. So most of us, I suspect, are very familiar with that side of Buddhist practice. But there is the other side, the side of opening. Singhamati was evoking this in Sangha night 2 weeks ago, or exploring this with us. And it's complex. How we relate to that is complex. Just to say a few things about it. Maybe these metaphors will work for you, maybe they won't. The first thing is, starting off with the most provocative thing, if we take the teaching of rebirth in any way seriously, well, the teaching of rebirth says that Newton or Einstein or somebody says energy cannot be created or destroyed. And the teachings of rebirth say that holds true for our psychic energy as well. So the momentum of our minds, the kindness, the love that we bring about in our minds continues. It does not go away. So if we take that seriously and think that's true, then you start raising all kinds of interesting questions about the literal existence of awakened energies. Because actually, if we're saying that this energy of awakening and kindness continues, and maybe it aggregates, well, maybe there literally are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas out there who can be called upon, these forces for good in the universe. So that is, I'm definitely not saying that you have to agree with that. I'm not sure if I believe that myself, but I do find it an interesting way of challenging my sort of literal, nihilistic kind of everything ends at death thinking. It's like, well, if these forces of wisdom and compassion continue, then maybe there are these vast forces of kindness alive and at work in the universe, and maybe we literally can call upon them. The second way of thinking about this is, and all of these are challenging in a way, actually. It kind of connects to the first, really. This business of binaries. So we so strongly think that I exist and Padmasambhava does not exist. That's with very, very strong propensity. I'm real because I can touch this and you can hear my voice. Padmasambhava is not real because he's a story from 1,000 years ago. And really what Buddhism is saying is, you're wrong on both counts. You're not as real as you think you are. You are not as real as you think you are. That's the whole teaching of no self, isn't it? For we attribute a realness and a fixity of identity which is inaccurate and is an inaccurate interpretation of experience. Of course, we're having an experience, but to box it so much is an inaccurate reading. So the way I like to say it to people is like, if you imagine I'm real here and Padmasambhava is not real here, actually what Buddhism is saying is maybe Padmasambhava is a bit more real than we think he is, because we're definitely not as real as we think we are. And in the middle, there's the messy complexity of experience, and that's actually a more accurate reading. Something to think about. Like I say, I'm not telling you. And then finally, of course, this is leading on to the bit I want to say next, is, the Tibetan tradition talks about this prayer on different levels. There's different kind of interpretations you can place on it. And as you go deeper or higher into those teachings, they more and more focus upon the non-separation of the awakened consciousness with lived experience, which in a way is what I was getting at a second ago, actually. But they maybe they make that more palatable. So the extent to which the awakened energy lies within us. So when we're calling upon Padmasambhava, what we're really calling upon is our own higher power, or the awakened consciousness that is present and available in every moment of experience. Which is probably the most palatable reading for us, but as I'm about to say, I'd suggest maybe there's a problem with that, or there's a limitation with that. So yeah, so that's a little, at least a little bit of what the prayer means. So in a way, it's a it's a movement, isn't it? So you start, it's a movement towards, it's an evocation of awakened consciousness, and then an invitation for that to manifest in our direct experience. You could put it at its most simple, it's that. So it's an evocation of awakening being possible, and then a calling that awakening into our lived experience. So again and again, and that is the crucial defining feature of Buddhist tradition, it's evoking the limitless possibility of human consciousness and saying that can happen here and now. So to say a little bit more about the different levels of Tibetan tradition's understanding of this prayer, this is like reading about it, like basically it's really quite complicated. I was thinking, well, what is the point of this? How is this relevant to us? And I suppose you could say, well, there's two things you could say. One thing is, of course, teachings and have resonances on different levels. And it's in a way, it's just good to explore the different kinds of associations things have, to see the different ways we can relate to them. So it's a multiplicity of meaning rather than being limited meaning. But particularly the thing I want to draw out, which I find really interesting in the Tibetan tradition, is you definitely start off with this sort of like the binary. We're here, Padmasambhava's here, we're asking him for help, he's literally existing. And as you go up for kind of the levels of sophistication of the Tantra, it gets more and more subtle and more to the point of it's all about your internal energies, it's all about the unawakened energy in your being, welcoming in the awakened energy in your being. You see what I mean? So it becomes more and more psychoenergetic process rather than a literal existing figure. What I find interesting about this is us with our sort of, maybe me, probably you, think, that's the level of simplistic superstition, and really I'm up here with the sort of like the subtle psychoenergetic integration business. And actually that's the truth, and this is just superstition for the sake of the silly people who can't understand that. It really seems that the Tibetan tradition doesn't see it that way. Very, very strong, valuing of faith in quite a literal sense, in quite a real sense. So as many of you will know, the Tibetan tradition really loves massive repetition. We're talking hundreds of thousands. So it's traditional to do 100,000 of something. And actually, if you're serious, you do multiple hundreds of thousands. So we spent about 45 minutes chanting that mantra this morning. Tibetans would do that for days. And they think that's a good thing. And what's interesting is the guys who are right up here on the top of this site, kind of Dzogchen or whatever you want to call it, a ladder, they think it's a good thing too. They don't deny the importance and significance of that behaviour. So little Dado Rinpoche is one of Sangharakshita's key teachers who helped him translate this prayer. One of the little stories from his life, which I've been thinking about in connection with this, is so towards the end of his life, he went on a final pilgrimage, on his final journey to Bodh Gaya. And he knew he was dying, and he was really, really poor, and he was running a school, and they had real money problems. And as he was going around on this pilgrimage, he was giving money to people all the time. And his very, very dear friend of decades was saying, "We can't afford this. Yeah, you can't, you know, you need to stop doing this." Dado Rinpoche was a realized being. He'd realized the non-separation of self and other. Just read accounts of his life. It's obvious that he's seen through that. And what he said to him again and again is, if you saw how important the act of generosity was, you wouldn't try and stop me. If you knew, like I know, how important this act of generosity is, you would not try and stop me. And this is coming from a man who's right up on the kind of the top of the wisdom totem pole, he's seen that this whole division between him and other people isn't real anyway. Yet he's saying, yeah, but to act in a generous fashion is of incalculable value. Something about, it's just been on my mind thinking about this. It's like, well, I don't fully understand that, but I find it really interesting. I haven't realised the separation of self and other, but I do not value the act of generosity as much as he does. So in a way, I've got neither of those things. But to try and think, well, what would that be like? So Tibetans make a big deal of repetition. Do it a lot. So what this makes me think of is one of those classic Buddhist teachings which we draw on very, very heavily because it's so valuable. So it's the three levels of faith. So there's the level of faith which is a reason, it makes sense. So for many of us, that will have been a decisive moment in our engagement with Buddhism. We'll have read something about Buddhism. We think, that makes sense. I agree with that. It seems true to me. Then we've got what could be called emotion, the feeling. It feels true. I'm sure we'll have all had those, for many of us, relatively rare moments when we're doing something and there's a real emotional resonance of this is true, this is right, this is important. Maybe it will have happened, who knows when. Maybe you'll have had that response reading a book, in conversation, listening to a talk, in a puja, in a meditation, chanting a mantra. A tangible, like a felt sense of truth. And then the level of faith that is experience. So in a way, thinking about this, I wonder if for me, if for many of us, particularly in the realm of a kind of like a faith, devotion, chanting mantras, doing pujas and stuff like that, I wonder if sometimes we don't realise which of those three dimensions of faith we're working on. So often in talking to people about ritual or whatever, they'll say something like, oh, it looks like everyone else is so into that. I'm just not into that. Yeah, or something like that. Or it looks like some kind of story about everyone else having an emotional experience of faith, of commitment, of joy, of engagement. And they then have a story that that's what they should be feeling. Well, as probably most of us know, it's just not like that. Most of the time, I would suggest, slightly heretical as this may be, most of the time for most people in pujas, they are not having a strong experience of faith and devotion. Something else is going on. Occasionally, we might have that. I can definitely think of times in pujas, in mantras, where I have had a strong sense of devotion, of connection. But that is occasional. So really, what we're working with is on the level of experience. So you see, what I'm trying to say here is, because what I notice in myself and other people is when we think about the level of experience, what we think is an experience which points us back to a previous emotional experience. Do you see what I mean? So it's like, oh, it felt good that time, and that's why I'm doing it now. Based on past experience, a confidence in the current experience based on a memory of a past experience where it felt right or good. Of course, that's valuable, that's useful, that's important. But I think there's another way of looking at it as well, which is, just trying to evoke that really. So I was thinking about this. I was thinking about that Karate Kid movie, which some of you have seen. Some of you will have seen the remake. So there's a particularly important scene, which I hope is in the remake, for those who haven't seen the original. So it's all about this young American, those of you who don't know the story, it's this young American kid who's being trained in karate by this old wise sensei guy. And basically the sensei guy isn't teaching him the tricks and he's fed up. He doesn't want it. And at a particular point, both in or maybe all three movies, certainly two of them, there's a similar point. So in one of them, the guy's just got him cleaning windows, and he does this for ages, for like days. It's like, and he's got this whole thing, hasn't he? Wax on, wax off. Everyone remember that? Wax on, wax off. And he just does this for ages. He's not having a good time. He doesn't feel good, and he doesn't know why he's doing it. So neither reason or emotion are present. Yeah. He's just boring, fed up. It ties us back to Milarepa and the towers, doesn't it? So, of course, those of you who know the story, you get to the end of the movie, and, of course, you have this important final showdown kind of fight. And in the fight, the guy's really fast, and he's coming at him, and he's just doing this all the time, and he's habituated this blocking response, and he can do it really, really fast and really, really quick because he's habituated it. So maybe, in addition, when we're thinking about faith, confidence, trust, so all I'm saying is, when we're thinking about faith, confidence, trust, we can think of it in terms of reason. It makes sense. I agree. The core teachings of Buddhism, actions arise in dependence upon conditions. If I'm horrible to people, that will go badly for me. I understand that, and I agree with it. I can see it, how it works. And then emotion, it's like that moment when we're in a horrible mental state and we sit down to meditate and our experience changes. It works. We have a direct emotional experience of freedom arising. We know it. We feel it in our bones. But this reason, this level of faith, this level of confidence that comes from experience, what I'm suggesting is it needn't just be referring back to past experience, but also, and this is the tricky bit, isn't it? Because it sounds like just do it. It sounds like the sort of faith that many of us will be suspicious of because of our religious backgrounds, or just sort of being told what to do and not understanding why we're doing it. So what I'm just trying to evoke is something about, giving that more time, giving that more confidence, trying it out, seeing how that goes. It's important to do that with awareness. It's important to, it's important to do that with awareness. So one of the things I found interesting this morning as we were chanting the mantra is I'm not feeling particularly well today. So my mind was definitely trying to go to somewhere more pleasant. So I was trying to escape and think about something else. And I found that I couldn't because I had to concentrate on what was happening. I don't know if anyone else had that. So it's like actually mindfulness was required. So it wasn't, so I'm not talking about like a dull kind of, just do it. What I'm talking about is just doing it with mindfulness present and an awareness of how that experience unfolds, an awareness of how that experience impacts on us. Because just do it and it like, just do it, that's Buddhism's core value is awareness, so that can't be good, can it? But doing it with just doing things sometimes with an awareness of, okay, well, I'm just going to do this for a while, see how it goes. Yeah, so there's a tension between developing positive habits and making ourselves do things in a dry, dead, forced way. So in a way, that's just evoking that. And the reason I'm invoking that particularly today is because, as soon as you start engaging with Tibetan Buddhism, it's so strong in that culture, a confidence in the positive value of repetition, which I wonder if I could do with having that a bit more in my mind. So of course, this takes us completely full circle back to the historical Buddha. So one of the lovely sayings of the Buddha is, just as a pot fills drip by drip, so by performing skillful actions, my mind becomes full of virtue. Just as a pot fills drip by drip, so by performing unskillful, unmeritorious actions, my mind becomes filled with pain. So really, that's for myself, I think that's what I realize I need to have greater confidence and trust in. The Buddhist tradition talks about different levels of karma. So to put that very, very straightforwardly, it talks about habitual karma, strong karma, can't remember the technical word for it right now, weighty karma, and death proximate karma. The three kinds of actions which have an impact on our experience. Well, death proximate karma is what you're doing just before you die. You don't have very much influence over that. And I suppose I wonder in myself, well, I wonder in myself and in us, that we overvalue weighty karma. So we're waiting for intense experiences to arise. And somehow that kind of ties in a bit with the faith which arises in dependence upon emotion. It's like we're waiting for something big to happen and then we will be confident. Then we'll do it. And really what Buddhism, I think, is saying is just attend to the habitual karma, because that's the most, the level of karma you have most influence over. Just do it slowly, slowly, over time, and it will change your mind. And in a way, we all know that, don't we? We're all at different stages on our Buddhist journeys. But really what this is a call to have greater confidence in the power of habitual karma, setting positive intentions and letting those slowly expand and influence our minds. Whether that be in the field of ethics, of meditation, having the confidence to communicate with people, the confidence in the Buddhist teachings, it's like actually just over time having greater and greater confidence in the gradual process of transformation. Because really that's what Padmasambhava is saying, that's what Padmasambhava is inviting into us. Although he's talking about it on this incredibly mythical level of an awakened child and Darkani's dancing around the sky and all of that, really what he's saying is trust in the power of karma, trust in the power of the intention of your actions to influence your lives. That is what it would mean to follow in his example. And the blessing that he will give us is the blessing of the transformation of our minds in the light of karma.